Welcome to the South Carolina Lead, a podcast that breaks down state political news for you and provides insight on the legislative happenings under the Statehouse Dome in Columbia. Hello, I'm your host, Gavin Jackson, and this episode is for the week of June 25th, 2019. This week, we recap the political news that came from the South Carolina Democratic weekend, including nearly all the presidential candidates who appeared before thousands at the state's convention and Jim Clyburn's world-famous fish fry. The events came in the middle of a backlash to comments from frontrunner Joe Biden and ahead of the first debates this week. The Lead is a podcast where we go behind the headlines with the reporters who wrote the stories affecting you. Every Tuesday, we give you a roundup of news, insight into the week's biggest stories, campaign trail intrigue, and a chaser of trivia. You can listen to all four sections while you work off that fish fry on the treadmill. Yeah, there was more than just fish, I know. A couple drinks.
Brown liquor.
Or while you wonder about this time warp that we are obviously stuck in when Toy Story, Child's Play, Aladdin, and Men in Black are in theaters, and Billy Ray Cyrus and Madonna are dropping new music. What year is this? And now for our brief quorum call. Quorum call is a term to see if there's a majority present, but here on the South Carolina Lead, we know a majority of the time that you're not always current with the news. So here's a quick recap of several top stories you should know about. And just a quick FYI, we rolled campaign trail into the main discussion this week, so there won't be a campaign trail separately from the discussion, which we talk about the campaign trail a lot in. So it's more of a campaign trail discussion versus a separate campaign trail. Campaign trail. Number one, the official census won't be conducted until 2020, but the latest census estimates show that South Carolina is growing at the ninth fastest rate in the country. The Post and Courier reports that the state's racial demographics have changed the least since the last official census in 2010. The state remains about two-thirds white as it has been since 1960. This is because South Carolina's population growth has been driven by people relocating from states like New Jersey and New York, states where the white and non-Hispanic populations have dropped. Number two, boondoggle update. The state newspaper reports former Santee Cooper CEO Lonnie Carter is being interviewed by federal police as part of the ongoing investigation into the failed VC Summer nuclear construction project. Carter will be interviewed next month. Investigators are looking into what executives of Santee Cooper and SC&G knew about the project and whether they misrepresented the project's progress. Civil lawsuits accuse executives of fraud. Number three, the Charleston Post and Courier reports that Boeing has reached a deal to sell 30 of their 787 model Dreamliners to Korean Air and Air Lease, including 20 planes built exclusively at Boeing's North Charleston plant. The three companies announced the agreement at the Paris Air Show. The order is valued at $6.3 billion and is the first for Boeing since the grounding of the 737 MAX 2 months ago. And number four, Mox Pit update. The state newspaper reports the federal government is proposing the construction of a multi-billion dollar plutonium pit factory at the Savannah River site near Aiken. The plan would add close to 1,700 jobs and would convert a scrapped mixed oxide fuel factory into a source of plutonium for the nation's stockpile of nuclear weapons. The U.S. Department of Energy says the country's capability to produce plutonium pits is limited, and this plan is necessary to mitigate the risk of plutonium aging. Nuclear watchdog groups argue plutonium pits pose a risk to the environment, and the government could use the pits to produce a new type of nuclear weapon. And for our Florida Man News segment, every week we give you a little headline, a little taste of the most captivating Florida Man news. This week's headline, Florida Man Dressed as Spider-Man Spotted Power Washing Roof. And just like Team USA burying goal after goal on the net, yeah, we're not making any apologies for that. Thailand, more like Cryland, yeah, we might get some diplomatic heat for this, some backlash from this, but you know, we're not gonna apologize for winning. Keep up the good work, Team USA. Take on Spain and win. We're saying this 10 minutes before the game starts. Bury the lead, bury the world. Thousands of people, supporters, 22 candidates, hundreds of media, tons of fish, and bands made for a historic Democratic weekend in South Carolina. South Carolinians got to see up close nearly the entire Democratic field this weekend, which made for a long Friday night at Jim Clyburn's world-famous fish fry and an even longer Saturday at the state party's convention, where candidates spoke for 7 minutes each throughout the day. To recap all the weekend's events is Jamie Lovegrove with the Post and Courier and Meg Kennard with the Associated Press. Welcome back, guys.
Hello.
Hey, Gavin.
Meg, start us off with the fish fry. Set the scene for us, what it was like out there. We've been talking about this. There's a lot of fish. There's a lot of bread. There's a lot of people.
Yes, a lot of all of that. A lot of media, a lot of attention, a lot of candidates, the most we've ever seen on one stage at one time. I took a picture at the end of the night. A lot of people did. That was basically a class photo for most of everybody who's running for president.
Get it now while you can.
All wearing, right, before there's a little bit of a winnowing of the field. But there was a lot of energy going into that event. Like you said, it was very amped up. It had been well publicized. Now it's the world famous fish fry. This is not the not the modest event that Jim Clyburn started decades ago in a parking garage, a parking deck in downtown Columbia. There were thousands of people. I never really got a final count. It was maybe somewhere around four.
I heard five, six, seven. Yeah, okay.
I heard it was a lot of people. I don't know if I believe that. But there were thousands of people who were there to hear all of these candidates, to see Jim Clyburn introduce each one, and to really hear what basically amounts to an elevator speech from each of these candidates. If you've been around them, if you've been on the trail, you didn't hear anything new. Mm-hmm. There's no news that gets broken at these kinds of things.
Right.
But for the party, for South Carolina, and for the candidates, it's a good opportunity to get a lot of media attention and to really show everybody that they're serious enough, at least for now, to come to this convention and to do what you do in South Carolina, which is spend some time with Jim Clyburn.
That's kind of like our most Iowan event, if you will, Jamie. Like, I mean, we're gonna have these guys going to the state fair eating corn dogs that come to the fish fry and eat fish. What was it like out there for you? What did you see? What did you hear from people?
Yeah, it was a really it was a party vibe. You know, I mean, the one thing that I think was disappointing almost in some ways was because there are so many candidates and so much time was spent on the speeches, we actually didn't really have sort of the after party kind of feel that we have at some previous fish fries with the dancing. And people were kind of heading out. It was getting very late.
Very hot.
Right. It was very hot. We had more folks there than Iowa had at their Hall of Fame dinner a couple weeks ago, more than they've got scheduled for the steak fry in a few weeks. South Carolina really has become right up there with those states at this point, and and it really certainly cements what we've known for a long time, which is that Jim Clyburn is one of the most influential players in the entire Democratic primary, not just in South Carolina at this point.
Yeah, I mean, he had all the candidates wearing his name on their T-shirt, essentially, and a good way to label all those candidates since there were so many of them, too. I think, Meg, maybe one of the more surprising things that I heard coming out of it, because I wasn't unfortunately able to go, was that Joe Biden had such a short speech.
He did. It was very nothing new, nothing different that we really hear, but it was pretty brief. All the candidates got a generous moment. I think we've talked about that time frame, whatever that means. It ends up being about a minute, 2 minutes for each one of them. But it was interesting for me, at least, to gauge some of the crowd reception. It was clear, and there were a lot of people kind of milling about before all of this began, different factions out in the parking lot there between the State Museum and Edventure with signs and megaphones and really just kind of drawing the energy up for each candidate. Some of those people made it in and lasted several hours until their candidate actually came up on stage. And so to see, you know, those different groups in the audience kind of pop up whenever there was that minute or 2 minutes for each one to get up there and speak. It's not an accurate bellwether of what their support is like in the state, but it is kind of neat to see, you know, some of that energy translate at this event.
And we were also hearing that Andrew Yang had quite a good showing out there too. Jamie.
They were out there. And it was, you know, what was fascinating too about the fish fry was getting to see the candidates interact with each other. You know, they were kind of corralled right next to the stage as they were going up one by one, and we were kind of standing next to them and watching, you know, basically the entire Democratic presidential primary field all kind of in this small little area together, interacting with each other, interacting with the crowd. You know, it was interesting to see that Joe Biden was one of the last folks to leave at the end. He stayed for a long time after the fish fry, taking photos with people and greeting supporters. And you know, in part, that could be seen as a way to fend off any suggestion that he's too old for this thing. You know, he stuck it out. He was there till 11:45 ahead of a long day at the convention. So, you know, it's just a cool opportunity for voters to get up close and personal with these folks and to ask them things if they want to ask them things, or just to take a photo with them and meet them and get to say that they may well have met the next president of the United States.
And that right there goes back to the whole genesis of why the fish fry came into existence. It was supposed to be that opportunity, not just to thank Jim Clyburn's staffers and supporters after his own campaign, but also provide that opportunity for some of the quote-unquote elite and the actual politicians to mingle with just, you know, regular folks around here in South Carolina. And it's still, even though there were thousands of people, there still were some of those opportunities. So at least it's kind of getting back to its roots a little bit.
Did anyone else stand out in any way? I know, Meg, you're saying that their speeches were all pretty similar. And I mean, were there any big jokes or any laugh lines or anyone that you've really maybe felt some momentum
at least? We got a good dad joke out of Cory Booker. Mm-hmm. They got a good laugh out of Clyburn and the crowd, which was let's not flounder. Let's get out there and kick some bass. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Some good fish-themed dad jokes.
Yeah,
and he has really taken on that mantle of being the dad of the field. But again, I said going into the fish fry that nobody remembers the fish fry for what was said. Yeah. What you remember the fish fry for the spectacle, the scene, the feeling out there.
You're there to be seen and seen. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you know, I think what you also take away is that South Carolina Democrats and Democrats in general are feeling pretty optimistic right now. You know, there's you could look at a field this competitive and this large and unwieldy and say, oh, are Democrats going to make it more difficult to take on President Trump after the primary is over? But I didn't get that sense from anybody. I mean, people are feeling good about the direction of the race right now, and there was a pretty optimistic vibe all around.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
Switching gears, what was it like in the convention hall the next day? You guys said you got a couple hours of sleep, it sounded like.
Just a few.
And it was, you know, back at to it in the convention hall. What was it like in there? I know there was a variety of different approaches some of these candidates took to their messaging, their appearance, and how they kind of brought in different groups. What was it like in there, Meg, on Saturday?
Some of the candidates did keep it pretty standard. You know, there are many activists in that room, so I would wager to guess that most of them have been out on the trail and seen at least one of these candidates somewhere live and in person. So again, no news was being broken. They weren't hearing anything that we haven't heard before. But there was a marked difference, I think, for some of the campaigns in terms of the actual energy that they brought into that room. This was a long day. Mm-hmm. The convention gaveled in at 9, gaveled out at 6.
Yeah.
So, you know, with 20, I think we did end up hearing from, 23 candidates?
Yeah, with Robbie Wells coming in there.
Right. Wasn't anticipating that. But with 23 candidates plus party business going on, you know, there was kind of an undulation between candidates speaking and then the party kind of handling some pro forma things that they have to handle at these kinds of conventions. But, you know, aside from the pretty standard messaging that we heard from a lot of them, I mean, I'm sure we're going to talk about it. Beto O'Rourke came in with essentially a fan club and a very loud one that was chanting and really amping itself up in the hallway outside the convention hall, so much so that I couldn't hear what was happening in the convention hall. So I went outside in the hallway just to kind of see what was going on. So that's what we kind of expect at some of these events, right? To get that energy back up in this very, very long day of hearing from all of these people. But in terms of messaging itself, there was a lot of attention on the line of it doesn't matter what happens over the next couple of months. As soon as our own nomination process is done, we as a party have got to come together and do what it takes to defeat Donald Trump in next November. That was mentioned specifically by several candidates, including Joe Biden, which I found very interesting. Obviously, he's the front runner still in terms of all the polling that's been done. But for him to really get out there and explicitly say, look, we got a lot going on and none of us agree on absolutely everything. But once we get through this, we all should have one goal, and that's to win next November.
Well, of course, with Joe Biden, it should be said that part of the reason why he may be saying that is because he thinks that he's going to be the nominee.
Correct.
And he knows that there are some people who don't like that. And so he's telling them in advance, if I'm the nominee, you better
come around.
But you
even have Sanders saying that, too. It's
like, everybody is saying that. Yeah. Absolutely. Everybody's saying that. And it's a big applause line. And we've heard it on the trail.
Oh,
you know, folks will ask people, are you
going
to support the nominee? They all pledge to do that. It's a big applause line every time. So there's certainly a push for a lot of unity. Coming into that morning, as you said, we had very little sleep after the fish fry. Came in a little tired. Kamala Harris, I think, woke everybody up.
She had
the drum line from Lower Richland High, and they got the vibe going from the get-go. It is not necessarily easy to be the first speaker up at around 10:30 in the morning, but she brought a lot of energy. She talked about what we've heard about her talk about on the trail, prosecuting the case against President Trump and using her prosecutor background. What some might have thought would be a disadvantage may still think that she's trying to turn that into an asset for her campaign. So she brought a lot of energy. Elizabeth Warren was right after her, also has a big group of supporters here. We did have this sort of mid-afternoon lull when there was a lot of candidates people are not as familiar with and are losing some patience with as they just kind of keep hanging on to this race without garnering more than 0 to 1% in the polls.
And people you said were like kind of being talked over by people in the audience.
Right, it sounds like, yeah. No, people just kind of started tuning out, but the party quite smartly scheduled Beto O'Rourke, Cory Booker, and Joe Biden as the last three speakers, which really brought a lot of energy back into that room for the close and was, you know, a fitting way to bring an end to that exciting day.
Yeah, there was some point, I think it was right after lunch, where the convention chair, Senator Gerald Malloy, stood up and said, okay, guys, so we've heard from, I think, seven candidates so far, so we have about, you know, 13, 14, 15 let to go. Yeah. And there was an audible groan from the hundreds of people in that room. They know the math. They know how many candidates are left to go. But it really did kind of drag on there for a little bit.
And I have heard out on the trail as well, when I go to some events, you know, I'll ask people who they're thinking of and I'll say, you know, there are 23 candidates out there. You know, who are you looking at? And they go, ugh, for one thing, we need to not have 23 candidates. Yeah. I mean, it's just, it does feel like a little bit of a you know, the Republicans have of course, made fun of it. They've said this is a clown car. Mm-hmm. That was the kind of messaging from the SCGOP going into this. And so, you know, we are heading into the debates now. And it was interesting, by the way, just as an aside, the fact that we were all talking about unity, they were all saying that going into the debates when you might start to see them draw a contrast with each other. But, you know, after the debates, it will be interesting to see if the money starts running dry for some of these folks and if the field starts whittling down a little bit.
Yeah, I was going to say, and then you also said there were also some highlight moments from the convention itself when Beto O'Rourke kind of went off script and brought his whole speech into the middle of the crowd instead of being on stage. So, and then you also had people like Booker coming in with, like, you know, dancing on into the convention hall. So a lot of different approaches, I guess, to kind of keep people engaged and kind of get a little standout affection at that point.
Yeah, and to portray a sense of real support here in this state.
Yeah.
I mean, this was being televised. There was some controversy about how that was going to go down. But it was on national television. And so for an audience outside the state to see that on television, whether it's an accurate fractional representation or not, still for them to see that, you know, South Carolina is getting a lot of attention and these candidates are doing well here, or at least garnering some support.
The O'Rourke thing was a coup for the advance team, I think. I mean, it was a little strange in the hall, but if you watched that on TV, it was a really compelling backdrop for him, for the national audience in particular. So that was a pretty smart move to do that. You know, another person we haven't mentioned that was a little bit of a different tone this weekend because of other things that are going on for him was Pete Buttigieg. He sort of tried to turn all this controversy that's going on in South Bend regarding racial issues with the police into kind of part of his presidential message. But he was clearly a little shaken up by everything that's been going on back there. He went back on Sunday, faced more pretty hostile questioning from some protesters there. So his campaign is in a very interesting test moment right now. He missed the fish fry on Friday night to stay in South Bend. Decided to come, but didn't bring a ton of energy, and then got criticized when he went back to South Bend for coming. You know, people were saying, are you going to go back to South Carolina after this? So he is the one candidate in the field right now who is facing a kind of external threat to his candidacy.
And we were talking about this was carried live on national TV, on MSNBC, sorry, cable television, not national television, but still national. There was a big hiccup over that. Meg, you covered a lot of that with the party giving exclusive on-air rights and streaming rights to MSNBC.
Right.
South Carolina ETV managed to get streaming rights to the event as well after we spoke with the party. And everything's good going forward. There's no qualms. But there were some issues with other networks trying to get that message up. Because this is, I mean, like we said, there's like 150 registered media for that. You know, everyone wants to have a live shot.
Yeah.
Obviously, not everyone's going to carry every moment of it. C-SPAN would. But other networks weren't going to do that per se. But they still wanted to have that national audience because this is not just South Carolina, it's national.
Right. And it was difficult because the party had said that there was going to be a 3-hour embargo on any video being showed from the convention until after it was over. So that means 9 p.m. would be the first time that anyone else, aside from MSNBC and ETV ultimately, could have shown anything on any sort of platform. That ended up not really being the case. All the networks were there. Many of them were doing live stand-ups and carrying some of the speeches contemporaneously. And MSNBC, frankly, broke away from some of the speeches that it had been said that they would be carrying in their entirety. The party said that that was part of the reason that they decided to do this, to give equal time and equal exposure to each of these candidates. It all ended up, I think, the way that it was going to end up, perhaps, anyway, aside from C-SPAN, who would have taken it gavel to gavel, as they do with state conventions and their the Road to the White House series. But there was some controversy because of the way that it was announced, which was just really several hours, when you think about it, before the whole thing was to begin in the first place. And many networks had already mobilized and made their plans in terms of what they were going to do with coverage. So that kind of cast a weird pallor over the whole thing. But I think ultimately networks did what they were going to do. There's probably some back end stuff to be worked out between the party and several of them. But I think that it was a well-covered event.
Yeah, I mean, it, you know, at the end of the day, above the fold front page of the Sunday New York Times was photos from the South Carolina Democratic Party convention. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, I think everyone left the convention feeling, all the Democrats left feeling like it was a tremendous success. The MSNBC studio did kind of add a sort of national attention vibe to it. You know, even Trey Walker, Governor McMaster's chief of staff, who's put on mm-hmm. his fair share of Republican events in South Carolina, mm-hmm. you know, praised, I think he said, you know, the most significant South Carolina Democratic Party event in his lifetime. Mm-hmm. This was historic. It is something that I don't think any of us will ever forget. I don't think anyone who was there will ever forget. Mm. And we're probably never going to see a field like this come to South Carolina yeah. at this moment ever again. So, you know, I think at the end of the day, I certainly got the sense from everyone who was involved in putting it on that they felt like it was a real winner.
Mm-hmm. And kind of going back to some news that came up before the convention, too, that I want to see maybe if it carried into the weekend. You know, we heard from Bakari Sellers, who's backing Kamala Harris, kind of say that Jim Clyburn is tacitly endorsing Joe Biden mm-hmm. because he's spoken positively about Biden and, you know, the crime bill in the past 1994, and then also just some other issues. And, of course, we saw Biden kind of we saw Clyburn come to Biden's defense over the segregationist comments. I'm mm-hmm. wondering, was that anywhere near the convention? Were people talking about these issues, or was it really just they wanted to focus on this party atmosphere instead?
I think that particular blow up may fall into the category of news that becomes big news on social media, right. but isn't necessarily something that's on the ground that delegates or other political watchers are really bothering with. Of course, everyone takes sides. Clyburn will at some point decide whom he's going to officially support. He and Sellers perhaps will be on different sides of that. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But you know, when you really talk to the delegates at the convention and other people who are paying attention to what the candidates are saying, surrogates, endorsements, they matter to some degree, but they're not really directly affecting what a lot of quote-unquote regular voters or people in the state are talking about, worrying about. It's something that journalists have to talk about, operatives sure. have to talk about, because it's all kind of like who's in, who's out, who's up, who's down, right? Inside that's baseball. That's covering yeah. politics, yeah. yeah. It's and like then, covering yeah. sports, same kind of a thing, but it's not really real life.
You know, mm-hmm. when we did the poll a couple weeks ago of the Democratic primary field, and also actually all South Carolina voters, we asked about social media habits. 65% of South Carolina voters said they had never used Twitter. Not rarely. You know, there was another 25% who said
who
they rarely
people?
Use
How could
Twitter.
I become more like
65% had never used Twitter. Uh-huh. By contrast, 1% of voters said they had never used Facebook. So really, if you think about if you're looking at your social media feeds and trying to figure out what is the closer to what people are actually talking about in their day-to-day lives, look at your Facebook feed. That's true. Much closer.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I think that has certainly become a point of contention. Mm-hmm. I also would say that Jim Clyburn, in a lot of ways, is reflecting a view that I think we heard from a lot of particularly folks in his demographic, older black voters in South Carolina who make up a huge portion mm-hmm. of the electorate. You know, it will be interesting to see this year whether there is a higher turnout among younger black voters. But historically, older black voters have been the most important demographic in South Carolina. And as we talk to them, we do get a lot of that sense of we get it. We've been around a long time. We know that folks had to work with segregationists. We know that folks had to work with Strom. And Joe Biden's comments were unartful. I think that's sort of the conclusion a lot of them seem to have reached, but they don't seem to be disqualifying. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of people don't seem to be paying attention to them. Certainly, by the way, there is clearly an undercurrent in the Bakari Sellers, Jim Clyburn situation about mm-hmm. that seat, which Bakari Sellers has wanted for quite some time, is planning to run for. Jim Clyburn's daughter may also run, and he has been kind of talking her up.
So there's a lot more going on.
There's a lot yeah. going on here, yeah. A lot going on beneath the surface, more than meets the eye. So.
Well, and then we also had Clyburn mentioning in an NBC News interview about just how he's kind of surprised that Senators Kamala Harris and Cory Booker aren't doing as well in South Carolina, these two black senators. Mm-hmm. And he said on Harris, you know, she hasn't done enough to lay out her policy proposals. Yeah. She responded, have you come to one of my events here in South Carolina? Because we know that she's been around many times, just like Booker. And he said about Booker, I think he is suffering from the shadows coming out from under the shadows of Barack Obama. So interesting to see Clyburn kind of weigh in on that.
You know, that was taken as like harsh criticism, but my reading of that quote was a little different. I mean, the fact that he said, I'm surprised they have not caught on. I mean, he's saying like they should do well here. Mm-hmm. Clyburn, by the way, has been to at least one Kamala Harris event that I was at. So it's not like he hasn't been there at all. You know, so that was taken as some shade. But I think he's saying what I think a lot of us think, which is Kamala Harris and Cory Booker would feel like natural fits for the South Carolina demographic. You know, they haven't quite taken off yet, but I will say I think both of them have two of the best sets of staff in South Carolina.
Agreed.
They have been laying out a great ground game. They are building volunteer networks all around the state, and they're putting in the work that I think is going to be really important for them to peak at the right time. Let's not forget, we're still very early here. Sometimes you don't want to be peaking right now. You want to be laying the groundwork to peak at the right time, closer to the primary.
And that's part of the problem to which we've referenced several times. Mm-hmm. There are so many people in this field.
Right.
So being able to break out and have that moment and just kind of rise above everybody is difficult for most of these candidates. So the debates are going to make a big difference in that, and that's going to give more singular opportunities, really. I mean, there's still going to be 10 people on stage at a time. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But that is going to provide more of an opportunity for some of these candidates to maybe just get their message out there a little bit more than they've been able to do. And then that will, I believe, directly translate into some of the attention that they'll be getting then in these states when they come back after they've had that national stage exposure. Then coming back here, I think you'll see a different reception for some of them.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with being consistent and constant right now at this stage in the game. And I didn't see a quote from Trev, the South Carolina Democratic Party chairman. He said, it's still wide open in South Carolina. I don't think South Carolina is going to be one on name alone this year, clearly.
Yeah.
Irvin seemed buying there. And there are just too many candidates and too many variables. And Jamie, I think you wrote in your story, there's like, what, 250 days until our primary in February?
Yeah, 250 days as of, I think, today, Monday. Mm-hmm. The name situation certainly has helped Joe Biden, but I also think the size of the field has helped Joe Biden. So again, we mentioned this previously, but if the field starts whittling down and if it becomes clearer to voters that they have a specific choice here between one or two other people as opposed to 20 other people, that may start to create some difficulties for him. But he clearly starts with a huge head start here. Also, of course, watch Iowa, New Hampshire. I mean, that has always affected the South Carolina primary. It was huge for Barack Obama in 2008. He had started to gain ground, but Iowa, winning Iowa was huge for him because it proved that viability, which is another thing that black voters really care about. A lot of them do in South Carolina is they want to know that you can win. Mm-hmm. That's something that has been an asset for Joe Biden so far, is this idea of electability. But if you can show them that you have that quality as well, that could turn the tables a little bit.
Mm-hmm. And wrapping up here, we're going into this week with Wednesday and Thursday, the first debates with these candidates on stage. Meg, what do you guys got some new AP numbers out too, kind of looking at what the vibe is like right now.
Mm-hmm.
Was this a good warm-up, I guess, for the candidates, this convention, the fish fry, and now we get some different numbers? What's it looking like going in towards these debates?
Yeah, of course. I mean, the more opportunities these candidates have to get out in front of people, the better. And there was so much attention on South Carolina this past weekend that only naturally served as a way to help them along with that. In conjunction with NRRC, AP has recently done some national polling on the field. And one of the biggest takeaways from those numbers is nearly three-quarters of registered Democratic voters say that experience is the most important thing to them going into this primary. So obviously that draws on some of the things we've talked about with Joe Biden and some of the other candidates in the field who've been elected multiple times, who've had experience doing various things throughout government. That remains something that is very important to a lot of voters. But another takeaway from this is only 22% of registered voters say that they know anything really about any of these candidates, and about a third of them really would consider themselves not paying super close attention. So again, it is still early, but I think that the first round of debates that we're going to have are really going to draw in some of the people who may have been on the fringes, who may just be vaguely aware of, oh, there's a campaign going on, yeah, there's all these people running around. But seeing these people on stage, seeing them contrast directly with each other is going to be perhaps the beginning of raising that level of awareness, even among people who would consider themselves to be pretty politically aware.
Yeah.
It all just has begun at such an earlier stage this go around that I really, honestly, I've said it before, I can't blame people who aren't paid to do this like we are. I can't blame them for not being nearly as plugged in.
Yeah, and you know, this also goes back to what I was saying earlier about ground game. There are large swaths of South Carolina that are rural. There are folks who are, you know, just not going to hear about these candidates unless you show up to their door. And that's part of the, again, the advantage that Joe Biden has is they're starting with him as the default, and you've got to go to them in person and convince them otherwise. And unless you do that, he's going to hold on to that lead. So, you know, what I'm interested to see over the next few months is how these field programs start developing, you know, how candidates are trying to reach the voters directly. You know, we started to see a lot of the campaigns buying the South Carolina Democratic Party's voter file so they know who to contact. I think that is going to be a significant factor moving forward. The campaigns do not always matter a ton. Sometimes they matter at the margins because, you know, at the end of the day, people are just going to vote for who they like. I think this primary with this kind of crowded of a field, who has the most organized campaign is going to make a huge difference in South Carolina.
Absolutely.
Gotcha. Well, a lot to look forward to. And again, we're still very far away, so we'll have plenty more of these discussions going forward. Thanks again to Jamie Lovegrove with the Post and Courier and Meg Kennard with the Associated Press.
Always good to be here.
Thanks, Gavin.
In our final section, Did You Know?, we focus on one quirky function of the state, politics, or government. It's named after the parliamentary procedure that lawmakers use when speaking to each other. Did you know that South Carolina Public Radio's Russ McKinney is here with some state trivia for us? He is. Russ, welcome.
Present.
Will you come back from the beach again? I mean, it's
no,
you know,
in just, town
oh,
this past week. But I noticed one day last week on June 19th, my telephone, my calendar said that June 19th was Juneteenth.
Yes.
You're familiar with that?
Yes.
That is
familiar with slavery and after the Emancipation Proclamation due to the Civil War.
Correct. It observes the abolishing of slavery in the state of Texas, but apparently is fast becoming the emancipation date or holiday in a growing number of states. Because for the last 150 years, Emancipation Day has always been observed on New Year's Day. Why, you might ask? Well, because President Abraham Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation on January 1st, 1863, changing the legal status of some 3.5 million enslaved African Americans. It ordered the freedom of slaves in 10 states, and of course, South Carolina was one of those states. In reality, though, most slaves weren't freed until the end of the Civil War in 1865. Union troops first arrived in coastal South Carolina, though, in 1861, early in the war. And in those areas where the troops were, the slaves had already been freed. So on that day, January 1st, 1863, the day that the proclamation was issued, thousands of freed slaves in the state flocked to a community. And for the first public reading of the Emancipation Proclamation, a day of jubilee, as it later came to be known for the 150 years. In which city did that first public reading of the Emancipation Proclamation in the state and possibly the country take place? A, Walterboro, B, Beaufort, C, Charleston, D, Georgetown.
Well, I mean, I feel like I want to go with Beaufort just because I was just down in Beaufort thinking about Tabernacle Baptist Church.
Oh, that's good reason.
Gullah Geechee. Yeah, because I was there. That makes it mean. Yeah, no, that's not what it is. Just because, you know, I was learning more and more about it when I was down there recently for that Better or Work event makes me think that it is probably Beaufort. I mean, you think of the Gullah Geechee Nation down there and those ties, especially Harry Tubman, Robert Smalls. So I want to go. That's what's going to influence me to go with Beaufort. But then I'm also, I mean, I'm going Beaufort, but I'm thinking, If it's anything else, it might be Charleston. But I'm going to say Beaufort. I'm going to go with what I think.
Well, instead of a guess, that's a logical choice on your part. The answer is B, Beaufort.
Yeah, there we go.
On New Year's Day, 1863, thousands of slaves flocked to Camp Saxton, which was a Union establishment in Beaufort, kind of close to Port Royal, in actuality, for the first public reading of the Emancipation Proclamation. The Union troops had a stronghold in the state, Beaufort, Port Royal, Hilton Head, since early in the Civil War. So therefore, those slave, freed slaves were in that area.
I don't think Russ is ever going to be proud of me, but AT wanted to know if you were proud of me.
Did I say I was?
That's exactly what I'm saying. Yeah, it's good to know some more background before you make guesses. Logical response. Thanks, Russ.
My pleasure.
The South Carolina Lead is one of many ways SCETV wants to help keep you informed. Check out the latest news and live streams on scetv.org. Listen to coverage from South Carolina Public Radio and watch This Week in South Carolina, a show where I talk with the newsmakers of the week on SCETV, Fridays at 7:30 p.m. and Sundays at 11:30 a.m. All of that, this podcast, and more is available on SCETV's Super Easy to Use app and southcarolinapublicradio.org. Subscribe to us, and we'll have a new episode for you every Tuesday on Apple Podcasts. Search us easily on your Android, the NPR One app, or wherever you find podcasts. And be sure to rate and review us on iTunes, like our friends of the pod, Lil Jams, Boots Amick, and El Loco Scientist. Follow us on Instagram at @scleadpod, and you can see photos from the studio, on assignment, and of course our dank memes. We're also on Twitter with the same handle at @scledepod. We have swag, sticker swag that is. Send us a direct message on Twitter or Instagram with your address, and we'll send one your way. Email questions, comments, or your gripes to scledepod@scetv.org. The South Carolina Lead is produced in partnership with South Carolina ETV, South Carolina Public Radio, and a special thanks to the Post and Courier and the Associated Press. Our producer is A.T. Shire. Sean Birch is our supervising producer. Sean Scott is our intern. Tom Posey is our executive producer. This episode was recorded and produced in South Carolina Public Radio's studios here in Columbia on June 24th, 2019. I'm Gavin Jackson. Thanks for listening. Secret message. We're always worrying. Please don't leave us. 5 stars. 5 stars.